This is the Ice at Dartmouth podcast. Moral judgments, claims we make about what is right or wrong, good or evil, have a role in human life. We mostly take them for granted. But is it always obvious what we are doing when we say something is right or something is wrong? Or perhaps, what is the point in making a moral judgment? This is a question that Dr. Eric Campbell works on. He is assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We are going to talk about his views concerning the role that moral judgments play in society. This work falls under the field called metaethics, and Eric will talk to us a little bit about what that field is. Let's just get started. Do you want to tell me a bit about what the project of metaethics is?
As you said a little bit ago, people start out with a basic understanding of what ethics is. Not an intellectual understanding, but an experiential understanding. People know what it is when you're arguing about what's right and wrong and good and bad. So if that's ethics, the if we conceive of ethics as, first of all, a kind of activity where people are thinking and also talking and arguing and all that stuff about, broadly speaking, good and bad and right and wrong, then metaethics is going to be some activity that's directed at that first activity. So metaethics is about ethics. So the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is the closest thing we have to a kind of authoritative general, well, encyclopedia. So this one starts saying metaethics is the attempt to understand the metaphysical, epistemological, semantic, and psychological presuppositions and commitments of moral thought, talk, and practice. I realize that's a mouthful. So I'm not going to just move on from there. I'll tell you, like, if you talk about a metaphysical presupposition, well, here's one very well-known presupposition. Do moral judgments presuppose certain kinds of reasons, namely reasons that don't depend on your own desires or interests? So like practical reasons. Well, one kind of question a metaethicist can ask is, think of metaphysics as just something, you know, anything like to do with fundamental reality. So metaphysics is like a inquiry into the fundamental reality. If something is morally wrong, then you have a sufficient reason not to do it. So that's one kind of presupposition, a metaphysical presupposition. And then other ones, epistemological just means how to do with knowledge. How do you know? So if you say X is morally wrong and I say X is morally right, epistemological questions are asking, how do we know? Right? And semantic has got to do with meaning. So if I say, again, stealing is morally wrong, what does that mean? If we think of ethics, let's think of it this way. If we think of ethics, as some philosophers certainly do, as this sort of broadest possible question, how to live. So any question that's aiming at that at all in any way, what kind of jewelry to wear, I mean, anything at all that's asking how to live, how to be, let's think of that as ethical. And then that the moral is really a subset of that, and one that, you know, depending on who you talk to, like, didn't even exist at all until a few hundred years ago. So like the word moral into ancient Greek, they just did not have a word for that. To me, that's super, super fascinating and very, very interesting, and ought to at least cause us to think a great deal about what we're presupposing by how our minds are structured by what we think of as moral discourse. There seems to be something very deep about moral discourse that looks like it's basically divine command theory with God taken out of it. There's commands. They don't even pretend to be justified in terms of what you want or what you value. And I mean, even your very, very deepest concerns are simply never directly relevant. They can be relevant, of course, but they're never the things, they don't ever bottom out there. Moral justification will never, ever bottom out in what is good for you, even in the deepest sense of like really spiritual, psychological, emotional health. That's just not where a moral justification is going to bottom out, is this is what's deepest, the healthiest thing for me. It just doesn't work that way.
So we're coming into tension here, in particular with Kant, I suppose, thinking that there's a big difference between reasons that are moral and then more individualistic or self-interest sort of reasons.
Yeah, so this is another way of getting at the getting at something that structures are thinking nowadays, as contrasted to the ancients, is that we have this kind of dichotomy between like self-regarding and other-regarding reasons. So moral reasons are generally thought to be other-regarding, or at least or duty-regarding. One of those two things. I'm either Kant. For Kant, it's all, moral motivation is all about acting from a sense of duty, and for other people, moral motivation is all about acting from a sense of something like benevolence or sympathy or something like that. Now, I think we can see both of these things are just clearly part of what we understand by morality. Somebody trying to do the right thing because justice demands it, to me, like looking at it as just as an anthropologist, is that the kind of stuff that we people consider to be moral motivation? Yeah, it is. Without trying to take, you know, it just being as completely atheoretical and unbiased, that just is. That's part of what we see as a moral motivation, as somebody who's trying to do justice. Trying to. We're not saying they're succeeding. And then also, I think we see, contrary to what Kant said, I think it's also the case that when you see somebody acting truly out of a desire to help other people, I think we also see that as a moral motivation. I think these are really two very central aspects, and maybe the two central aspects of what we understand as moral motivation. But either way, what the morally right thing to do is not supposed to depend on what kind of person you are, what kind of motivation you have. The morally right thing to do is something that, whatever it is, whatever the theory is, doesn't come back to your own interests, your own health, or your own flourishing. But then if people say, oh, well, then it's just a self-interested thing. It's like, well, no, but because that dichotomy isn't really there. That dichotomy between other regarding and self-regarding, where these are, it's either one or the other, is something that seems to have, that we seem to have gotten through a kind of Judeo-Christian and modern enlightenment world. Something I'm not competent to judge, but something has happened where we understand other regarding concern and self-regarding concern as just dichotomies. It's either your concern is this one or that one. And the self-regarding just doesn't have moral worth. So those two things are two of the things I think they sort of really deeply have come to structure our minds in ways that I take it we're not really there for ancient philosophers, just as an example.
Much of recent meta-ethics is using this dichotomy between reasons that motivate you towards others versus those that are more self-interested, I suppose. That's a you feel false dichotomy that meta-ethicists are using. Am I understanding
that
correctly?
That is one thing that I think is true. It's something I'm interested in, but the things that have occupied my interest the most, and certainly my previous written work, the first has been this question of attitude independence. I had to talk about two things. One is this attitude independence thing, which we did talk about, where morality, how the concepts actually work in our culture. There is, I take it, something very robustly attitude independent about moral judgments. It just in the sense that entirely common and ordinary for somebody to think that something's morally wrong and they're just not interested in what your values are. As far as answering that question, there's this is wrong, and I'm just not interested in what's good for you, or what's, at least not as far as answering that question goes. So that's this presupposition that you have very good or sufficient reason to do something, regardless of your attitudes or your values or your health even. It's not gonna, that none of those things are gonna change the judgment that this is bad or good or right or wrong. So there's that attitude independent conception of morality. And I've argued in previous work, I mean, my dissertation, but also published work since then, that feature of moral judgment that basically commands, do this, don't do that, that plays a kind of committing role. And what I mean by that is it's a kind of stabilizing and strengthening of motivation to do certain kinds of things that otherwise we'd be less likely to do. So many people, scientists and philosophers alike, have argued in one way or another something much like what I just said, that this the attitude independent aspect of moral judgment is a way of basically strengthening or stabilizing, organizing motivation. And there's a kind of intuitive sense in it, because if you have things that are hard to do, or if there's rules in your society and you're going to get punished maybe severely for violating them, well, it just turns out that people trying to avoid punishment is not a great way all by itself to actually succeed in that project, because people are so prone to rationalizing and really discounting future and probabilistic harms as compared to, like, if you can steal this bread right now and you're hungry, it's right here, you're definitely going to get it, then, like, but maybe I'll get caught and then that will be in the future, or what, or maybe I shouldn't, you're not supposed to sleep with this person or this kind of person. There's all kinds of moral rules that we and every other society sort of punishes people for. So there's a pretty broad agreement that this idea that there's certain things that you just should not do, or certain things that you must do, regardless of how you feel about it, helps play a kind of role in stabilizing motivation in adherence to the whatever the moral norms are. The way I got there made it particularly easy for me to see that there was some really substantial downsides to that that are very hard to see until you start looking.
Yeah, so it sounds a bit like, if I may. So the idea here is in part that if we're doing meta-ethics about a particular action, what understanding sort of the reasons behind that action, then those reasons would consist in stabilizing your motivation or giving yourself more resolve to follow through with that action, regardless of what sort of consequences you might face in doing that action.
Not only regardless of consequences, but even particularly regardless of whether you want to, of whether it's good for you. And there's a lot of metaphysics going into this. This is one of the things that, you know, to whatever extent we're trying to make connections with Nietzsche, he also told us that peoples are always trying to generate a metaphysical story of some kind to stabilize modes of life. And that theme has been picked up by a number of metaethicists since then, but not nearly enough, but a few people have picked up on that. And again, he understood that, and I think correctly, as to a first approximation, ways of stabilizing modes of life. And, if, you know, there's interactive, complicated effects, but if we're just trying to understand a very, very, very basic phenomenon, we all have an understanding of what religious metaphysics are. You've got some kind of entity out there, and he or it or whatever sees what you're doing, has commanded you to do this or that, but you're not. And he can see it, and he's going to punish you. But he also loves you, and, you know, whatever the metaphysical stories are that are supposed to maintain and stabilize modes of thought, modes of cognition, modes of life. But now, if you take God out of that picture, you take that religious metaphysics, you take the God out of the metaphysics, then if it's the case that these metaphysical stories have been playing a really important stabilizing role, then you need some new metaphysics. And other people have very different metaphysics that are totally naturalistic. Like if you're a utilitarian, then all there is pleasure and pain. And then there's just better ways of getting more pleasure and less pain. So, but anyway, all these metaphysical accounts are in one way or the other, according to Nietzsche, and I'm very sympathetic to this idea, they're disguises. They're not actually what they present themselves as being, namely a kind of neutral attempt to understand the nature of ultimate reality. Rather, they disguise themselves as that, but what their actual goal is to support and stabilize modes of life and thought and practice and culture.
So is it fair to say that what we really want is to avoid anarchy at all costs? And maybe there are lots of different stories that we have told, such as religious stories, say, mm-hmm. about actions so that we don't get anarchy, so that we get more stabilized practices and ways of living and actions. But all that's just so that we can avoid, I'm using the word anarchy because that right. seems like that's what you're talking about here. Is that fair to say?
So I think there's one extremely important truth in the neighborhood of what you're suggesting, which is that all of the things that I'm talking about, and every human culture has at its core both ability and will to organize groups of organized groups of basically unrelated people into some kind of coherent group. So in that sense, all of these metaphysics, all of the basic practices and rituals and modes of thought and modes of engagement, even ones that are super, super, super different, you know, whether it's Stalinism, Nazism, every as bad, as good as you want, they all do that. Otherwise, you wouldn't have heard of them. They all are able to organize substantial numbers of people around some kind of sacred ideas and values, sacred beliefs and values. That's whether it's Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, nationalist movements, anything, everything. And I think there's like loads and loads and loads of extremely good evidence of this from all different places that this is a core feature of every human culture that's, well, maybe just every human culture, period, but all the ones that we're at all really concerned with do play this role of suppressing not just individuality, but even factionalism. Like if you get little groups, like the bigger cultures, the cultures that we see nowadays, and even in the ancient world, except for the, you know, basically like, except for just like small tribal groups, everything that's around now has had some kind of way of suppressing or harnessing a kind of selfishness as we understand it, which also includes the selfishness of little bitty groups. You have to have the bigger the group, the less selfishness it can tolerate, whether you understand that as selfishness on the part of smaller groups or selfishness on the part of, so yeah, a kind of anarchy. If anarchy is, if what you mean by anarchy is a kind of everybody just doing their own thing in their own way, however they feel, yes, there's something about every culture that stands against that.
Okay, I think I then understand what's going on here. So that's quite stabilizing, but it's also quite oppressive and doesn't leave a lot of room for individual values, say. Is that where this is going?
That is definitely one of certainly Nietzsche's core concerns about morality. But it's not limited to morality. That thing is not limited to morality. You could have, despite what I just said about that thing that I take it that every culture has in common, but still, you know, I said you could harness individuality, or you could harness these things, or you could just like massively suppress them with total brute force. So like, you know, however oppressive you think either our culture or some other culture it is, there's probably something a lot more oppressive. There's enormous diversity in terms of how this very, very core project of social cohesion, very, very different ways that can be advanced and promoted. And some of those ways might involve absolutely brutal oppression, whether it's by race, gender, class. Other ways might be very, very, very much more tolerant or even encouraging of various individual differences, various group differences, and so on. So I don't think it's, first of all, I think we just have no, there is no way other than the total destruction of civilization to have something that, to have any kind of society at all that doesn't somehow play the role of organizing large groups of people into into some kind of very, I mean, it's very, very, I don't want to build anything more into this than what I'm explicitly saying. Is just somehow people have to be organized around something that isn't just everybody's just going to do. And I think from everything that we can see, every case that I know of, including many cases that wouldn't acknowledge it at all, there's always some kind of sacred beliefs and values. And what I mean by sacred here is something that's you're not really allowed to question it. And you're also not really allowed to understand sort of what role it's doing there. So what role is it playing? So like, and I take it, what I mean by that is it's playing some kind of organizing role. So every sacred belief and value is playing some kind of organizing role. Now, that doesn't mean it's not also really good in other ways. So I'm not trying to I'm not trying to debunk any kind of sacred, the very idea of sacred values. In fact, just the opposite. In fact, I think the more that we recognize that every culture that we know of, and I think we have excellent reasons for thinking that every culture that we don't know of is very, very likely organized around something like what I'm calling a sacred value, including ours, including academic philosophy. If we understood that, hey, we definitely have some kind of sacred beliefs, even if we don't think we do, otherwise we wouldn't be organized. But what's generally, what I think is going to be like a tremendous challenge and opportunity for us is to try to identify the sorts of things that are our sacred values and beliefs, and then to sort of just start asking certain questions about them. Are they, and not true, because their point isn't to be true. In other words, if you ask whether they're true, that's okay. You can ask that question, but really the answer is just going, it's a misleading question. It's like asking about whether an organ in your body is true. These things are literally, quite literally, they're just not selected on the basis of anything that really makes sense to call truth. They're selected and shaped and evolved through both top-down and bottom-up, mainly bottom-up, but also top-down mechanisms. They're selected on the basis of some broad kind of functionality, which is not totally obvious what the functionality is, but it's going to have something to do with its ability to organize people around something that they can look up to. That's part of what it is to be sacred, is that something that you can revere in some way or another. It's something that you're willing to sacrifice for, and something that you're willing to protect. So for us, we have ideals of things like equality, for example. So that's a kind of ideal. At least it looks like it's an ideal. It presents itself as an ideal. And we can ask, okay, well, is this something that we are really actually value? Because sometimes maybe what you call your sacred values are not, maybe you're valuing something else under that label. What are we doing when we're making moral judgments? Now, that seems like an old question. So I've argued that one of the things that we're doing when we're making these specifically moral judgments is committing to certain, not just certain modes of behavior, like not stealing, for example, but also to certain ways of thinking about those kinds of questions, or not thinking about those kinds of questions. Minds are shaped by cultures in such a way that after a proper acculturation, if the culture has done a good job, so to speak, that mind should have a very, very, very difficult time coming to have a different shape. It should not be able to run away very well at all. And it's not just because of the nature of that mind, although it's that too, but it's because of the nature of all the minds around it. So if we're all in Nazi Germany, everybody's doing the Heil salute, and you're not doing it, you're going to have problems. And I think, you know, I know it's, I'm not saying we're Nazi Germany by any stretch of the imagination at all. I'm really, really not saying that. I'm just saying that they didn't think they were either. The Stalinists didn't think they were either. Nobody, the cannibals didn't think they were, nobody thinks they're doing anything really very bad. And generally they think they're doing something very exalted. It's very off, right? The Nazis thought they were doing something extremely exalted. Other people think they're doing something very, very exalted. And I'm not saying everybody's wrong about it. What I'm saying is that the way that these things are constructed are that whether or not it's really good, whether or not it would survive some kind of whatever would count as a kind of genuine exploration of its value, they all present themselves as being definitely it would, or it shouldn't be questioned at all. And so there's something I think really deep about our moral discourse that clearly has those features. And again, it doesn't mean that we're doing things that are tantamount to Nazism or antebellum slaveholding, but again, those people thought they were doing something. Many of them thought they were doing something entirely appropriate and even really good and exalted. You don't allow, or even all the way to Jim Crow, you don't allow whites and blacks to marry. And it shows courage and strength to disallow this kind of degeneration. So it's just part of how cultures and minds build themselves that certain kinds of questions just aren't really permitted. And I have over the past whatever 15 years of thinking and writing about this, I think I've got a pretty good sense of how dangerous it can be to ask those kinds of questions, to ask, what are we really doing here? Or as Nietzsche asked, what's the value of these values? Which is a very strange question if you're used to thinking of values as either being true or false or something. But values themselves come about through all kinds of wacky, massively contingent historical circumstances. They're extremely often imposed by sort of top-down hierarchical propaganda, or they may be imposed by sort of bottom-up or horizontal propaganda and ideology. The thing is, whatever they are, however they got to be here, you can be damn sure that if they're here and if they've been around a while, they will have clothed themselves. They will have clothed themselves in some kind of pomp and finery. We know it's true. We don't even need any experiments. We know simply by looking at history and by the present reality. Whatever political party you support, you know for sure that at a bare minimum, half of the people in the country are like super deluded, right? They're like massively mistaken, but they totally are sure that you're mistaken. It's like the structure of the social mind, especially, I think, a moralized mind where that has these two components. One is certain things are right and wrong, regardless of what your own daimon says, for the Socratic term. Socrates said he was guided by a kind of daimon, a divine entity. But whatever your deepest values are, that's just not what morality is. And it also needs to take a back seat to what morality says. And then secondly, a deep, deep, deep pattern inherited partly biologically, very largely biologically, but also very largely through a Judeo-Christian heritage, which is heavily, heavily punishment based. You just don't see, it's not the same as every other culture. Other cultures are just don't have the same kind of reliance and elevation and exaltation of anger and righteous indignation. These are things that are here with us. And it's very, very, very hard to look at them because you're really not allowed to. And you can see everybody else is not allowed to. when they're the different ones, you can see that the antebellum slaveholders and the poor whites, that they're not, look, you're not allowed to actually ask a serious, genuine question. Is what we're doing here, are our values like actually good? You're not really allowed. You can pretend to ask it. That's okay. If you're a Christian, you're definitely allowed and encouraged to pretend to really question your faith. And I'm not saying nobody really does. I'm just saying when you think about the structure of a culture, it's a very different thing to actually seriously question something versus going through the motions of it. There's something about the realist character of moral discourse that makes it super hard to see one's own motivations. Now, why would they do? Imagine you're actually a realist and you're saying moral truths are totally independent of anything that I or anybody else happens to care about. That's the sort of core realist position.
And you think this is in part because of acculturation or society. Is that fair?
I think it's, I think yes. And I think that specifically something about what the function of realism is. So if you remember what I said some time ago, this is a common view. The function of realist thought, where realist is just another word for what I said earlier by categorical or attitude independent. So if the function of that way of thinking is to stabilize attitudes and practices, it turns out that that function is very seriously threatened if you're aware of it. What you really need for it to be stable to work is to experience it as something that has nothing to do with a plan at all. You experience it as a perception of certain mind-independent facts.
Which is peculiar in a way, if moral discourse was the kind of thing that only worked if you didn't know what was really going on when you participated.
That's exactly what I think. That's the crux of it. Yeah. That's really the crux of it, is that I think that's just essentially what's happening, is that the kinds of technologies that we've inherited, and in particular, both of these two, the very strongly punitive reactive attitudes combined with a very robust structuring of the mind to think in terms of things that are permitted and forbidden and required and all that stuff in ways that just have no inherent connection to your own sort of values or spirit or whatever you want to call it. These two basic, very powerful mechanisms, both of them, or if you want to think of them as one syndrome, will not work. There's a strong inverse correlation between how effective these technologies are going to be and the depth and breadth of awareness of the technologies themselves.
So what do you think, we should probably wrap up soon, but what do you think then we should do about moral discourse? Should we do away with it, or do away with the modern conception of it and return to what the ancient Greeks were doing? Or just remain ignorant and try to ignore the fact that moral discourse doesn't work if we know what's going on when we do moral discourse?
Yes. No. So I got sort of two big parts. One is that, unlike basically everybody else writing in the field, I don't think there's something that we all ought to do about it. I think there's very different groups and different peoples in different contexts. And I think I would say the same thing about religious discourse. Like if just because I think some people, it would be just absurd for me to think, all right, everybody right now is definitely the best thing to do is to drop all your religious discourse. That just strikes me as just utterly presumptuous. And there's no way I'd be in that kind of position to talk about what everybody ought to do. That said, the sort of approach that I am advocating for a certain set of people. What set? Well, the people who either already know or are interested in this kind of thing. If this is there's two things. One is, the more we learn about how this stuff works, the more it isn't going to work. So unless you think that if you want to actively sign up for remaining ignorant, I'm not really trying to argue somebody out of that. That person is already enough. If somebody genuinely thinks I'm committed and I want my group to be committed to staying ignorant, I may not be able to reach that person. Except if I said, well, hang on, so were the Nazis. and all that, like just that level of, yeah. So that'd be one thing I'd say is that when I talk about these technologies working, that isn't at all necessarily a good thing. It's what it is for them to work is to narrow your perspective. Now, I will acknowledge there's a great deal of value in narrowing your perspective, but also a very great deal of risk. So the more that we're actually interested in understanding ourselves, and also the more we're interested in genuinely asking the kind of questions that Socrates got put to death for, the more we're actually interested in, okay, are we actually living in a way that is healthy, flourishing, whatever kind of terms resonate, then I think it really behooves us to have this kind of adventurous spirit where you recognize it is dangerous. I think it's another thing that almost no meta-ethicists tend to do when they even the abolitionists, they tend to say moral discourse is kind of like the new atheists, right? The new atheists are telling us that religion is basically it's just all bad and we can do totally great and way, way, way better without it. And I think the other abolitionists tend to think that, and there's just a tiny handful of them, but they tend to think moral discourse is just so, so terrible. We'd be way, way, way better just totally getting rid of it. Whereas I think there's no guarantee of that at all. Either way, whether religion or moral discourse. But the thing is, if you're not able to believe in God anymore, then you better find something else. And likewise, if you like understand how these technologies are working, and you also can see, again, just like the religious case, you all can also can see, well, gee, the technology is working, often seems to lead to absolutely catastrophic levels of not only destruction, but debasement. But people like debase themselves seemingly in the service of some kind of religious ideology, but the same thing with moral ideology. But nobody who's in that thinks so, right? If you're in it, you don't think you're doing that. So it's really this call to have something like what you might call a kind of faith, or at least some combination of like faith and an adventurous spirit, that like when Socrates called us to know ourselves, and not just him, it was on the temple of Apollo before Socrates ever existed. This ancient injunction, the very first one on the temple of Apollo at Delphi in ancient Greece. And also I'm very influenced by sort of broadly Buddhistic thought. The Buddha apparently, supposedly told us, be a lamp unto thyself. There's something about this call and sort of innate will to become more aware of what you're actually doing that is really at the core of the whole thing. And then you could make all kinds of various probabilistic, consequentialist kinds of arguments about, well, what are the consequences likely to be? I can't tell you what they're going to be. I can tell you that it's very dangerous to try to become self-aware, and it's also very dangerous to not try to become self-aware. And to think that you can sort of have any kind of reliable speculations about what's going to happen if hundreds of millions of people try to become self-aware, and it's like, that's all that is. That's you can make sort of somewhat halfway educated guesses about what might or might not be more likely to happen. But that's not really what an adventure is about. That's not what's inspiring about these Eastern and Western injunctions to become self-aware, is that it's not that we'll be happier necessarily. We may not be, but there's just something in some people that really hearkens and just says, you know what, we gotta just, it's not because of some external thing. It's not because of some either transcendent standard, nor is it some lowest common denominator that everybody can necessarily get behind. It's neither one of those things. It's a kind of recognition and cultivation of a spirit to just be aware of what the hell we're doing, and we'll have to see what happens. that's to me, that's the thing that inspired, that's the thing towards which I have a kind of reverence that seems to just demand that I do it, and that inspires me to just try to get other people to see, you know, isn't there something in you that wants to wake up? Isn't there something in you that wants to see what you're doing? Even if it's scary. Maybe because it's scary. It's more interesting that way.
Those are very important questions, I think, Eric. We should probably wrap it up. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk about this. That was really fascinating for me. Thank you.
No worries.
Thanks for listening. I'm grateful to everyone at ICE at Dartmouth and to Eric Campbell for making this episode possible. We listen to The Wonder of Science by Lexan Music. Stay tuned for more episodes or check ice.dartmouth.edu. Thank you.